One bright sunny morning in Dingleydell, Flopsy Bunny said to her two baby bunnies, "It's such a lovely morning. I'm going to go and play in the field full of marigolds. And for lunch, I'll bring you back a nice big bunch of carrots." So off went Flopsy to the field full of marigolds. All morning she played and played. She was so happy she thought she would burst. When she finished playing, she collected up lots of carrots and set off home. On her way home, she met Billy Badger and Bobby Badger. "My, my, Flopsy Bunny," said Bobby Badger. "You've got a lot of carrots there." And then he hit her with a baseball bat. "Ow," said Flopsy, as she watched the badgers running off with her carrots. Flopsy cried all the way home. But when she got there, her baby bunnies were gone. "Where are my beautiful babies?" she cried. "The council people came and took them into care," said Mr. Weasel. "On account of you being homeless, your burrow's been compulsorily purchased by developers. They're going to convert it into studio flats and a shopping arcade." "Oh, no," said Flopsy. "If only I hadn't spent all day playing in the field full of marigolds. What am I going to do now?"
You can hear the second episode of Flopsy Bunny Goes on the Game, part of a series of children's stories about life in the real world, tomorrow at the same time.
It's time for the Million Pound Radio Show, and here are your hosts, Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Good evening, and welcome to a new series of the Million Pound Radio Show. In this series, we'll be profiling the Minister for Energy, Cecil Parkinson, and asking, is it coincidence that Sarah Key's electricity keeps getting cut off?
And Kurt Waldheim, This Is Your Life. In which lots of characters from Kurt's colourful past will be coming on stage, and Kurt will pretend not to recognise any of them.
I must say, it's great to be back. Tell me, Nick, what have you been doing since the last series?
Well, Andy, I've been diversifying into lots of different areas, really, you know. I had a very interesting 3-week job in Italy as president.
Oh. how'd you get that?
Oh, through the Brook Street Bureau. Oh. Yeah. They provide all the temps for the Italian government, you know. And how about yourself?
Well, I spent the summer conducting those tours around Sellafield, you know, showing the public how safe nuclear power stations are. I enjoyed it.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah, yeah. A bit hard on the voice, though, you know, because it's quite difficult making yourself heard above all those sirens.
Yeah.
But apart from that, great, kept me fit. I lost a lot of weight.
Lost a lot of hair, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I lost all my hair, actually. All my body hair, it all sort of just dropped off after the first few days. But it's nothing. The medical officer at Sellafield told me it's just, what did he say? Total hair loss through nervous tension. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's very common, apparently.
Really?
Well, it is at Sellafield, yeah.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, one of our Million Pound Radio Show exclusives. Throughout the summer, the world sat glued to the Irangate hearings. Crucial questions were raised, like, was President Reagan told about the secret policy? If he had been told about the policy, would he have understood it? Who does Fawn Hall's hair? And was the whole complicated, incredible story just Pamela Ewing's dream? But tonight, we have for you an exclusive tape of the confidential closed session in which Oliver North was under vigorous cross-examination.
Colonel North, can you assure us that your answers to this committee have been truthful?
Counsel, this is one Marine who will always tell the truth.
Colonel, in 1985, you testified to the Senate Committee on Nicaragua on oath, and you told the committee that you were, in fact, a creature from Mars visiting Earth on a peace mission.
Yes, sir.
Now, that was a lie, wasn't it?
Yes, sir, it was, and that's the truth.
Why did you tell the Senate committee you were from Mars?
To be helpful, sir.
Helpful? But you're not from Mars.
Of course I'm not from Mars, Council. But I told the committee I was from Mars because it was a lot easier to believe than what I was really doing. And even more important, I told the committee I was from Mars because my superior, Mr. Casey, who now just happens to be dead, said, just tell them you're from Mars, Ollie. They're so goddamn dumb, they're bound to believe you. So I did, because this is one Marine who obeys orders. And if I'm told, Ollie, shoot that giraffe,
yes, well, thank you,
I get up, I go.
Yes, thank you, Colonel. We'd like to move on to a new area. Now, in front of you, you'll see a memo signed by you sanctioning the sale of 962 nuclear missiles to a foreign power. Now, which foreign power received these missiles?
I don't rightly recall which power received them in specific detail, sir.
Right. Do the words Soviet Union mean anything to you?
Yes, sir, they do. They're a technical term for Russia.
Right. You sold missiles to Russia, didn't you?
Yes, sir, I did. I thought it was a neat idea.
Yeah. Did you mention to the president that you were selling nuclear weapons to Russia?
No, sir.
Why not?
Because I didn't want to worry him, sir. You know how old people worry. And besides, sir, the president specifically asked me not to mention it to him, sir. And if my commander-in-chief says, Ollie, stick your head in the oven.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, did other projected covert operations include compromising the Pope with an 11-year-old boy? Poisoning Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands and nuking Bulgaria for a bet?
Yes, sir.
Colonel North, how on earth did you expect to get away with all this?
Well, sir, I calculated that if I stood here in my uniform, wearing all my medals, beginning as many answers as possible with the phrase, this is one Marine, and ending them with the words, sir, mentioning my best friend, that's my wife, Betsy, and my little children as often as possible, pretending to get emotional whenever my honesty was called into question. And above all, looking like the man of action that every dull, boring American wishes he was. Then I calculated that the American people would let me get away with absolutely anything.
Colonel North!
Sir?
Case dismissed.
And now it's time for
the glory that was Hollywood. Yes, Hollywood, the Dream Factory. It all began about 70 years ago with Asylum Movies, and Hollywood's first great star was Charlie Chaplin. Who can forget those famous trademarks? The bowler hat, the bent cane, the mustache, the 13-year-old girl, the court appearance. Yes, Chaplin was the best. Here's one of the funniest sequences from The Gold Rush. Wasn't that great? Eleanor Hughes remembers the golden Hollywood of the 20s.
Oh, those were wonderful times. I remember how exciting it was. Time and time again, you'd go up for a part, you'd go and see a producer, and he'd screw you in his office. And then he said he'd call, and you waited and waited, but you never heard. And then you'd go up for another part, and the producer would screw you in his office, and you'd wait for the call. But you just kept on trying, because you just knew one day you'd get the part, and Hollywood would make you a star.
That was Eleanor Hughes. She spent 40 years in Hollywood, and never appeared in a single film. In the late 20s came sound, and for some great stars like Valentino, it was the end of the road.
The thing is, Rudolph, you're a visual actor. You're a physical performer. Now, I'm telling you for your own good, you're not cut out for the talkies, Rudolph.
Well, why not? Give me one good reason. Why not?
The talkies are films strictly controlled by those moral watchdogs, the Hays Office, who decreed that in all love scenes, actors had to keep one foot on the floor. This caused problems for a lot of stars, except Trigger. In the 40s, Hollywood was booming, with great movies like Casablanca Ingrid Bergman remembers.
Well, of course, they shot two endings to Casablanca, and neither myself nor Borgard knew which one they were going to use until the film was released. Personally, I felt they should have used the other ending, where the dinosaur came out of the sea and ate Casablanca.
In the 50s, more and more stars burst onto the scene. Charlton Heston, Marilyn Monroe, Paul Newman all left their famous footprints in the concrete of Sunset Boulevard, and Frank Sinatra left some business associates in it. Method acting was big in the 50s, pioneered by actors like James Dean, who died young as a career move. The 60s saw great musicals like The Sound of Music, the frustrating story of how the Nazis failed to kill seven revolting children. But by the 70s, the Hollywood age had come to an end. Yet the memory lingers on. Who can forget Fay Wray telling King Kong?
Look, I'm sorry, but in my experience, size does matter.
Who can forget the infamous flops like the Islamic musical Seven Brides for One Brother? Most of all, who can forget that Hollywood has given us magic, excitement, and above all, Ronald Reagan? Who can forget Ronnie's most dramatic line in the movies when he wakes up in hospital and says,
"Where is the rest of me?"
And we all thought he was talking about his legs. All part of the story that was Hollywood.
Thank you. Well, later on in the show, we'll be meeting a member of the Radical Animal Liberation Front unit who are planning a campaign to release zebra crossings back into the wild.
But first...
Hey, Andy, do you think genetic engineering's wrong?
Well, I don't know, really. Why do you ask?
Well, it's just that Muriel and I had a really big row about it last night, you know. See, we were watching this programme on genetic engineering, and I was saying that I thought under certain circumstances it was ethically justifiable, and Muriel said she totally disagreed. And then the hostage started chipping in, and, you know, the two of them were really having a go at me. So I said, look, you know, you've got to live with
hostage.
The
time... Hostage? Did you say hostage?
Yeah.
What do you mean, hostage?
Oh, well, we're trying to get a phone connected. It's the only way to do it these days. You take a telecom engineer hostage.
Oh, right, yeah.
So anyway, they were saying that the principle of embryonic research...
Can't you get into trouble for that?
No, provided the research is conducted under proper medical guidelines.
No, I meant for taking a telecom engineer hostage.
Oh, no, good God. There was a ruling in the Court of Human Rights a few months back. Oh. You can't cut off their ears or anything like that, no. You know. Well, not until you've been waiting at least 8 months.
How long have you been waiting?
7 and a half.
You shouldn't really do that, you know, Nick. It's not nice being tied up and threatened. It happened to me once.
Oh, right. Wasn't that the massage parlour in Copenhagen?
It was not a massage parlour in Copenhagen. I was captured by criminals. Ooh. A couple of months back. See, I saw these three dubious characters sneak into one of the lockups behind the flat, yeah. You know. Anyway, I'm listening at the door. Next thing I know, they've grabbed me, dragged me inside the lockup, and they stuck a gag in my mouth.
Make sure he's well tied up. We'll be out of the country before they find him. Okay, let's run through it one more time. Denny, you steal the van. En route, we put on the overalls and balaclavas. Denny pulls up at a bank. Baz, you cover the door. I get the manager at gunpoint. He empties the safe deposit boxes. We lock the staff in the vault, make our getaway in the van, swap it for the Cortina in Shergold Street, and head for the airstrip. Next stop, Marbella. Any questions?
One question, boss.
Yes, Baz, what is it?
Well, these balaclavas, they're not nylon, are they?
Sorry?
Well, it's just that last bullion job where we use balaclavas, you know, I've got this sort of skin reaction. I went to my doctor and he said, really, I shouldn't wear anything close-fitting on my face, you know. I said, I had to for my work, you know, and he said, all right then, but only natural fabrics.
Well, we're using these blue balaclavas here.
Oh, no, acrylic.
All right, then, we'll wear stockings over our heads.
Well, that's even worse. Doesn't let the pores breathe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
And they squish your face up, don't they?
Yeah, they make you look really unpleasant.
Ugly, look, ugly. Just shut it, you two. We'll wear the balaclavas. End of discussion. Any questions? Serious questions? Yes, Denny.
Yeah, but, well, it's about the bank itself.
Yeah.
Does it have dealings with South Africa?
What?
Well, like, if it does, I just don't think we should have anything to do with it, that's all. I mean, it's a very oppressive system over there, you know?
No,
I
just remembered. They don't have any dealings with South Africa. Okay?
Yeah.
Everyone happy? Good. Then maybe we can
One last question, boss.
Is it about balaclavas?
No.
Is it about South Africa?
No, it's about the getaway.
Good, far away.
Right, well, like, when Danny's, like, driving the motor, right, we won't be using leaded petrol, will we?
Jesus, Wes! I blame John McVicar. Look, we are bank robbers, single-minded, ruthless criminals who'll shoot anyone who gets in our way. Understood? And if all goes well, we'll walk out of that bank with 10 million quid. 4 million for me and 3 million for each of you. 3 million pounds.
Well, boss, we wanted to have a little word about the share out.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Only Baz and me, we don't think the split is very fair.
We reckon the split should be adjusted.
To make it more fair.
Oh, yeah? What are you proposing?
We each keep 50 quid and give the rest to Ethiopia.
Yeah. So, how long before you were released?
Oh, not too long. The robbers got caught. You know, the whole raid was recorded on camera.
Yeah, I read about it. Wasn't that the raid where two of the gangs stood in front of the bank's video camera and criticised the whaling industry?
Yeah. while the third one just banged his head against the wall in frustration. That's right.
Yeah.
Tonight on I Believe, we examine the most basic spiritual question that confronts man. Is there a God? And to debate this in the studio, we have Susan Holmes, Professor of Moral Philosophy at Oxford University, the Bishop of Nottingham, the Right Reverend Gordon Simpson, and last but by no means least, Emlyn Hughes. Emlyn, perhaps if I could start with you, is there a God?
Well, Andy, the way I see it, there is a God, you know, and the boy's done great. He's gone out there. And there's been nothing on for him, and he's created space for himself. He said, right, let's get stuck in and let there be light. And then he's gone on, he's created the sky, the sea, the earth, living things, little birds and bees and things that are terrific. He's done great, and I'm well pleased for the lad.
Yes, yes. Yes, thank you, Emlyn. Susan.
Son, in whom I am well pleased. Well pleased. And if God's well pleased, then I'm well pleased for him. Because whatever he does, he's great by me. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a case of thy kingdom come, thy will be done great.
Yes, thank you. thank you, Emlyn. Right, Susan, is there a God?
Well, I feel that although a God may or may not actually exist, I mean, mankind, nevertheless, as a species, evidently needs the spiritual reassurance of some supposed external and divine superbeing. So, in a sense, there may not be a God other than the God in the mind of man.
Emlyn, any thoughts?
Not usually, no.
Right. And so we turn to you, Bishop. Is there a God?
Nope.
No.
I reckon not, no.
That's not what you said at rehearsals, was it? Then you seemed to think there was a God.
Changed my mind. Bishop's privilege.
Yeah. It's the money, isn't it?
Well, I was having a brief conversation with Emlyn in the hospitality suite, and yes, it does seem to be getting considerably more than me.
Well, yes, but I mean,
it hardly seems fair, especially as I have had to endure sharing my airtime with a troglodyte with no knowledge of syntax.
Hey, pal, you leave the professor alone, all right?
The thing is, Bishop, right, it's BBC regulations, OK? Emlyn Hughes has to be in every programme now. He's homely and cheerful and...
Can we hurry up, please? I'm presenting Panorama in half an hour.
I want the same money as him.
Me too.
All right, you two, you get the same money. Now, please, we're running out of time. So, Gordon Simpson, Bishop of Nottingham, is there a God?
Ooh, I know this one! I know it!
Bishop, is there a guard?
Yes, there is.
Yeah, nice one, Bish. 2-1, yeah.
Oh, shut up, you...
Hey, don't you hit me. I'm a friend of Princess Anne's,
yeah, listen,
know.
Lads. Like...
I've been on Royal Celebrity. It's no, a knockout, but... you bastard.
Well... I'm afraid we've had to leave the million-pound radio show a little earlier than expected. So, let's go instead to the final episode of our children's story.
And Little Red Riding Hood said, "My, my, Grandma, what big eyes you've got." And the wolf said, "All the better for seeing you with." And Little Red Riding Hood said, "My, my, Grandma, what big teeth you've got." And the wolf said, "All the better for eating you up with." And the wolf leapt out of bed to gobble up Red Riding Hood. "You're not my grandma," said Red Riding Hood, and shot the wolf in the head with her .45 Magnum.
And you can hear the next episode of Little Red Riding Hood Scum Killer, part of a series of children's stories aimed at the American market, tomorrow at the same time. But now, another chance to hear a BBC classic episode, in other words, a repeat, of an award-winning BBC series.
Journey with us into the spaghetti junction of the unknown for another in our series, Tales of the Impossible. This week, episode 2 of The Man Who Didn't Belong.
The story so far. Brett Tempest has been in a serious crash. For a few fleeting moments, he was clinically dead, but now he wakes to find his wife, Jane, at his bedside.
Oh, Brett, thank God. I thought I was going to lose you.
It's okay, Jane. Everything's all right.
Jane poured Brett some water. Brett sensed there was something wrong.
Jane?
Yes, Brett?
How long have you been left-handed?
Oh, don't be silly, darling. I've always been left-handed.
Brett felt alarm surge through his being. He pulled up Jane's sleeve.
My God! Your tattoo!
What about it?
It's on the wrong arm. And this other tattoo, look! Princess Diana was facing the inside of your thigh, not the outside.
It's always been like that.
Don't you see what's happened? Everything's the wrong way round. I've stepped into a parallel universe. A parallel universe where everything is outwardly the same, but is in fact reversed.
Yes, Brett had indeed stepped into a parallel universe where everything was outwardly the same, but was in fact reversed. A new world, a world impossibly opposite to his own. A world where the sun rose in the west, where a compass pointed south, where rivers flowed uphill, and where Ronald Reagan ran American foreign policy. In this frightening world, reality had been turned upside down. Brett snatched a nearby newspaper and read the headline.
British players dominate Wimbledon? Oh, my God!
Brett felt dizzy. The shock to his system was too great. As he lost consciousness, he heard Ted Rogers being funny on the radio. Weeks passed and Brett went home with Jane. One evening, Jane switched on the TV. A woman's face appeared.
And I just want to say it was all my fault, and I'm very, very sorry.
That was a prime ministerial broadcast by the Right Honourable Mrs. Margaret Thatcher.
Brett sat bolt upright in his chair. He stared at the screen. Yes, yes, it was Margaret Thatcher, but he hadn't recognised her with her long blonde hair and her Laura Ashley smock, covered in nuclear power no-thanks badges. Brett stammered.
That's Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, best leader the Labour Party ever had.
Labour? Then who's leading the Conservatives?
Why, him, of course.
A chill descended on Brett as Neil Kinnock's unfreckled face appeared on the TV screen. Kinnock spoke one short, precise sentence, and then he stopped. He actually stopped. Rex could stand no more. He ran, panic-stricken, from the house. He ran and ran through the streets packed with tens of thousands of triumphant Fulham supporters celebrating their 9-1 win over Juventus. Rex ran out of control, his head thumping. An intelligent-looking policeman asked him if he was okay. But he just kept running. He ran into a tube station. A train arrived immediately and startled him. The train doors opened, but Brett couldn't get on the train. To him, it was alien. It was unnatural. It was clean. There was only one way for Brett to cross back into his own world, only at the gates of death. He raced back to the house. On the doorstep, a double glazing salesman was taking no for an answer. Jane stopped Brett. She was frightened.
Brett, I'm frightened.
Don't worry, darling. I know what I'm doing. I love you.
Brett leapt into the car, a turbocharged Robin Reliant. And he drove out at breakneck speed along the free-flowing M25. Heading for oblivion for survival.
That was episode 2 of The Man Who Didn't Belong. In episode 3 next week, Brett's sanity collapses when he meets somebody nice in advertising.
Well, that's all for this week. Next week, a spokesman for the Labour left will be explaining how they didn't try to win the last election because they don't believe in the competitive ethic.
And we'll also be announcing the winner of our You Are Geoffrey Archer and I Claim My £2,000 competition. Thank you very much and good night.
The Million Pound Radio Show was written and presented by Andy Hamilton and Nick Revel and featured Felicity Montague and Harry Enfield. The show was produced by Paul Mayhew Archer.